perpetrator, to ensure accountability for the perpetrator and justice for the victims.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Donatella Rivera, Senior Crisis Response Advisor at Amnesty International, lead investigator on the new Amnesty report titled Ethiopia Summary Killings, Rape and Looting by Tigrayan Forces in Amhara. And finally today, the biggest news. Nermeen, would you like to break it?
A very big congratulations to our dear news director, Dina Guzder, on the birth of her baby boy on February 11th. Welcome to the world, Rustam Guzder Turner.
Rustam, we are so excited about this new little chapter in the family of Peter and Dina and all of us at Democracy Now! That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a job opening. Rustam isn't quite old enough yet. For Human Resource Manager, check it out. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Moving On is broadcast on KBOO every Friday, right after the noon news to 1:30. On Friday, February 25th, Moving On will present part two of a celebration of Black History Month. We'll hear music from the Civil Rights Movement, as well as from contemporary folk performers Laura Love, Rhiannon Giddens, Reggie Harris, and more. Tune in Friday, February 25th, right after the noon news, to celebrate Black History Month, only on KBOO.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, today. A rare in-studio interview with civil rights icon Dorothy Height, recorded before her death. Ms. Height died on April 20th, 2010, at the age of 98, after a lifetime spent fighting for racial justice and human rights. She was at the forefront of the civil rights battle for over six decades and counseled political figures, including Eleanor Roosevelt, Martin Luther King Jr., and President Lyndon Baines Johnson. When she died, President Obama ordered the nation's flags to be flown at half staff. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. NATO defense ministers are meeting today to discuss new military deployments and preparations in the confrontation with Russia over Ukraine. At the same time, Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the NATO countries want to pursue diplomacy.
And we remain ready to engage in dialogue and find a diplomatic way forward. But while we continue to work for the best, we must also be prepared for the worst. We have already raised the readiness of the NATO response force, and allies are putting forces on standby and deploying more troops, planes, and ships.
Russian President Vladimir Putin wants NATO to stop expanding and guarantee Ukraine won't be offered membership. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said NATO expansion to countries bordering Russia threatens peace.
Europe's so-called open-door policy violates every legal norm and commitment and is turning into an unstoppable expansion of NATO in the East. That is threatening the security of the Russian Federation, and we've informed our interlocutors of the steps we are taking in our dialogue with the United States.
Russia said it has pulled back troops from Ukrainian borders, but NATO said it had not seen evidence of that yet. President Biden said an invasion remains distinctly possible. The families of nine victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting have agreed to a $73 million settlement of a lawsuit against the maker of the rifle used to kill 20 first graders and six educators nearly 10 years ago. The families and a survivor of the shooting sued Remington over how it marketed the AR-15 style rifle used in the shooting. It alleged the company targeted younger at-risk males in its advertising, like 20-year-old Adam Lanza, the shooter. David Wheeler is the father of one of the victims, 6-year-old Benjamin. He said the settlement should send a message to the weapons manufacturers, the banks that finance them, and their insurance companies that there will be a steep price for irresponsible behavior.
One of the reasons Ben's not here is because some people made a decision driven by an increased desire for profits and a fear of a shrinking market share to focus their advertising on young men, to sell them their product. The most intentionally lethal consumer product our species has ever devised. They behaved irresponsibly to make more money, and their corporate partners turned the other cheek.
Remington had said the lawsuit should have been dismissed because of a federal law that gives broad immunity to the gun industry. The U.S. Supreme Court, though, declined to hear the case. The House Select Committee investigating the Capitol insurrection has subpoenaed six more people, including former Trump campaign members and state lawmakers. The panel is further expanding its review into efforts to falsely declare Donald Trump the winner of the 2020 election in several swing states. It is seeking testimony and records from individuals who the panel says had knowledge of or participated in efforts to send false alternate electors from seven of the states President Biden rightfully won. Meantime, Biden has ordered the release of Trump White House visitor logs to the House committee. The visitor logs show appointment information for the people who were allowed to enter the White House on the day of the insurrection. Police have arrested former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez. It's a step toward fulfilling a request by the U.S. government for his extradition on drug trafficking and weapons charges. The arrest came shortly after a Honduran judge signed an arrest order and less than 3 weeks after Hernandez left office. It follows years of accusations about the Honduran leader's alleged link to drug traffickers. Federal prosecutors in New York repeatedly implicated him as a co-conspirator during his brother's 2019 drug trafficking trial, alleging his political rise was fueled by drug profits. The former Honduras president's brother was sentenced to life in prison on drug and weapons charges last year. The death toll in Brazil from devastating mudslides and floods that swept through a mountainous region of Rio de Janeiro state has reached 38. The region was slammed by torrential rains, which are characteristic of global warming. More than 10 inches fell in 3 hours. San Francisco voters overwhelmingly have recalled 3 members of the city's school board. Recall organizers complained about board priorities, including the board spending time on a process to rename schools honoring public figures linked to racism, colonialism, or sexism, while schools were struggling on how to educate children during the COVID-19 pandemic lockdown. The San Francisco Teachers Union opposed the recall. It pointed to the almost $2 million poured into the campaign by billionaires and wealthy venture capitalists. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
That was our news headlines. For nearly half a century, Dorothy Irene Hite has been at the forefront of the struggle for equality and human rights for all people. Her life exemplifies her passionate commitment for a just society and her vision of a better world. She was born in Richmond, Virginia on March 24, 1912. She later enrolled in New York University and earned the bachelor and master's degrees in 4 years. She was the first black person named to deal with the Harlem riots of 1935 and became one of the young leaders of the national youth movement of the New Deal era. She worked to prevent lynching, desegregate the armed forces, to reform the criminal justice system, and for free access to public accommodations for people of African descent. On November 7th, 1937 was a turning point for her when she met Mary McLeod Bethune, who was the founder and president of the National Council of Negro Women. Of course, Dorothy Hite has then went on to become the president of the National Council of Negro Women for several decades. She has served in many capacities. She's been the director of the Center for Racial Justice. She was elected the national president of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority in 1947, and she assumed the presidency of the National Council of Negro Women in 1957 until February 2nd, 1998. She is now the chair and the president emerita. She was involved in helping to set up Wednesdays in Mississippi in the 1960s, when interracial groups of women would help out at Freedom Schools, involved in voter education drives in the North and voter registration drives in the South, and establishing communication between Black and white women. Of course, she's traveled throughout the world in Africa, Asia, Europe, and Latin America, beginning as early as 1937. In 1952, she served as a visiting professor at the University of Delhi in India, in the Delhi School of Social Work. She, in 1966, she served on the council to the White House Conference to Fulfill These Rights. Her distinguished service and contributions to making the world a more just and humane one have earned her over 50 awards and honors from local, state, and national organizations and the federal government. She was with Vice President Hubert Humphrey. She received the John F. Kennedy Memorial Award of the National Council of Jewish Women in 1965. In 1964, she received another award from Hadassah. She worked closely with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., with Roy Wilkins, with Whitney Young, with A. Philip Randolph, and others. She participated in virtually all major civil and human rights events in the 1960s. For her tireless efforts on behalf of the less fortunate, President Ronald Reagan presented her with a Citizens Medal Award for distinguished service in 1989. She also received the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Freedom Medal by the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. Her awards also include awards from Essence Magazine, from the Camille Cosby World of Children Award, the Caring Award by the Caring Institute. She is proud that the National Council of Negro Women established and maintains to this day the Fannie Lou Hamer Daycare Center, the only monument to Fannie Lou Hamer in Ruleville, Mississippi. As a promoter of positive Black family life, she conceived and organized the Black Family Reunion Celebration in 1986 to reinforce the historic strengths and traditional values of the African American family. She has been recognized by universities all across the country. She has, I understand, about 32 honorary degrees. Those are Doctors of Human Letters, Doctor of Civil Law, Distinguished Medal, Doctor of Laws, including from Princeton University, from Tuskegee, from Harvard University, the University of Massachusetts, Smith College, New York University, College of the City of New York, Sojourner Douglas College, the University of Maryland, and many, many more. We are delighted and thrilled to welcome to the Sojourner Truth edition of Morning Review, Dorothy Height. And I must say that one of the reasons that she is here in Southern California is that she has also written a new book. She's written her memoir called Open Wide the Freedom Gates, a memoir by Dorothy Height. Welcome, Dr. Height.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Right now, there is so much that we can cover, but why don't we first start with your book, and then we could work our way back. Now, this is a time of your life with all of the achievements that you have made, all of the honors and accolades that you have received. You could just be sitting back, taking it easy, but instead, you are writing. You have a new book out. Why did you think it was important to publish a memoir and to be traveling around the country discussing your new book?
Well, when I look back and really think about it, everything I've accomplished has been with someone or with the support of others. But I've also had so many unusual opportunities that I felt an obligation, a kind of sense of in a sense, sharing some of what has been helpful to me, beginning with the kinds of teachings I got from my mother, from my home, but also from the kind of people I have worked with. I've worked on 5 continents, and I've had a chance to work with women and their governments on all of those continents, but I've also worked here with powerful people, but also with the poor. So I've learned a lot. I just want to try to share something of what other people have given to me.
Yes, and going back then to 1928, when you were at the nearly all-white Rankin High School, and you were forbidden to sing in the school assembly. You sang in the school assembly, did you? And you were forbidden not to do it again? Well, what happened?
Actually, Rankin is a tiny little town, about 7,800 people. It's a borough of Pittsburgh. And in this high school, the music teacher was itinerant, and she took me in her hands and taught me how to lead the group to sing. When we had a new principal come to the school, he could not understand this, what we call Negro girls then, standing up and leading the singing. And so as we were assembling, he told my homeroom teacher to hold me back. I hadn't had any chance to tell anybody this. She and I were the only two who knew it. And I sat beside her so that I could, you know, feel more comfortable. And when another African-American girl and I had written the alma mater, I wrote the words and she did the music.
Wow.
And so therefore, whenever they sang the alma mater, Dolly Slaughter would play it and I would lead it, as our teacher had taught me how to do. But when this principal saw me, he apparently didn't like it. So the next time we had an assembly, he gave this warning. And so though he called for the alma mater, nobody moved because they were waiting for me to go to the platform. And when I just kept sitting there, they just kept sitting. And Dolly played it again and again. And finally, I think the principal Straight, if his name was, I think he got the hint. And he called me to the platform. And I led it, and they sang it like it had never been sung before. But it was not an organized effort. It was a spontaneous reaction. And, you know, when I look back and realize I grew up in such a community where the population was predominantly foreign-born, and there were less than a dozen of us who were African-American in that group, I realized that what it meant, that the students all felt camaraderie. And I think we felt pretty strong, too.
Yes, that is quite remarkable, because here in 1928, you were leading the pack, and you haven't stopped since. You are still doing that now. For many in our audience in KPFK here in Southern California, we really have no idea what it was like to be born in Richmond, Virginia in 1912, when Jim Crow ruled and lynchings were not uncommon. I mean, you were raised, your mother was a nurse, your father was a building contractor. What was that like for you as a child growing up in that environment? Because many of the young people today, you know, we have voting rights and we have all of those things that you helped us to get, and haven't a clue really about what it was like as a child or even as an adult in that kind of environment.
Well, I think, first of all, my mother and father, when I moved to Rankin, to this little town, it was a steel mill town, that I was just 4 years old. But my mother was a nurse. And I think early in my life, I must have absorbed some of her reaction, because she was not only a nurse in Richmond, Virginia, but she was the head of nurses in a black hospital. But when she moved, when my parents moved to Pittsburgh and to Rankin, my father could be employed because he was self-employed. But my mother could not find a nurse, a registry of nurses, nor a hospital that would accept her. And I would hear her talking about, you know, nursing and this, what it meant to her. But it actually meant that the only way she was able to get a job was to take household work for $3 a day plus car fare. And she was never bitter about it, but she talked about it. And I think early on, I caught some of her feeling as well.
Yes, yeah, so to move from the training she must have had to become a nurse and to be in that position and then have to become a house cleaner, the situation, I'm sure, of so many of the women, you know, in her day. Now, as a child, you were a bit precocious. I mean, you weren't afraid to speak out, Jim Crow or not Jim Crow.
Right.
I mean, what gave you that impetus? I mean, why did you take the risk?
Well, I didn't see it as a risk. I remember when I was about 12 that I was a part of the girl reserves of the YWCA. And I took three of my friends down to the Chatham Street YWCA in Pittsburgh because I had been chosen to be the, I suppose you would say, the Negro girl on the poster with two white girls. We were standing for body, mind, and spirit. And I was so proud of this that I took my little friends and we tried to swim in the pool.
Uh-oh.
But we met it at the door. They told us we couldn't. But one of them began to get so upset. She said, well, let's go home. I said, no, let us go see the executive. And we went in and talked to the executive, and she said it was a policy and she couldn't change it. And I said, but I'm on the poster. And she's, oh, yes, and we're very proud of you. And we like to have, because I used to sing, particularly the songs when we had the dedication and the like. But she said, but I cannot change the policy. That, to me, was one of the first experiences I had dealing with overt discrimination. And to this day, I've never learned to swim.
Yes, so you could not swim in the pool as a young black girl, but you could be on the poster.
That's right, but you know, life is so funny, because years later, I went back to that YWCA when I was on the national staff, and I could tell them the story, but also that the Pittsburgh YWCA took some of the strongest action to try to eliminate segregation and discrimination.
Well, there you have it. To remind our audience, you're listening to Pacifica Radio. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and I'm delighted to be having a conversation with Dr. Dorothy Irene Hite, who has a new book out called Open Wide, The Freedom Gates. And, of course, she just embodies so much of our history. So I'd like to get right back into our discussion with Dorothy Hite. Now, you confronted people about discrimination, not allowing young black people to swim in a pool, and you made it through high school. Now you're ready to go on to higher education. Now, Barnard College, based in New York, today is known to be very liberal, but back in your day, they refused to admit you to Barnard. What was that about?
When I was in high school, I loved the sciences. I was always a good student, and I was valedictorian of my class. And I had a brother who advised me that Barnard would be a good school because I wanted to go into medicine. And I took all the exams, and I had beautiful letters, and I was accepted. I got a letter accepting me to come to Barnard College.
Oh, okay.
But when I got there, Dean Gildersleeve was very slow in assigning me, and I got a little jittery, and I said to her, you know, my train was a little late. She said, oh, that didn't make any difference. She said, we have two Negro students, and that's our quota. Belle Tobias and Vera Joseph were the two.
Wow.
And she said, you're young enough, you can come back another year. Well, that was like cutting my throat. Once I had finished high school, I was eager to go into college. But I was turned down on that quota. But when I went down to New York University, as my brothers advised me, he said, there's another school, go there. When I got there, my sister, who accompanied me, said to me, because when the dean asked me for my application or did I have my diploma, I had nothing with me.
Yes.
And so she said, my sister said, Dorothy, show her your grades. Show her the letter from Barnard College. And when I did, she looked at it and she said, a girl who makes these kind of grades doesn't need an application to New York University. So I, therefore, was admitted to New York University, and I loved every moment of it. But you know, as life moves, both Barnard College and New York University have given me honorary degrees, and I've had the opportunity to share that story with both of them.
That's a wonderful, wonderful story to share, and really a reminder of those terrible, terrible times, although we're not past those terrible times. When you got out of high school and you were able to travel to New York and go to university, were you aware then that you were somewhat in a special position? I mean, one, you had those terrific grades, which you worked hard to get, but the awareness of those who were left back in your hometown, those who were not going to make it to either Barnard or New York University.
Well, you know, I was really conscious of that even in high school, because a number of students who were with me in the lower grades did not make it. And when I tell you that the students who were colored for 3 years straight finished first, second, and third, I realized that it was kind of the survival of the fittest. So that I've always had a consciousness of how it is that some people are not helped along the way. And that's been a driving force in all of my life. I've always been concerned about what was going on with others. And even some of my best friends used to say to me all the time, well, they could do this or they could do that. I would say, no, let us see what we can do to help them. My mother taught me that.
Yeah, so that has been an inspiration to you then throughout your life. Yes, because I'm sure many people ask you, must ask you all of the time, what kept you going all of those years? I mean, you went from one difficult task on to another even more difficult task.
And my mother always said to me, and she never, I've dedicated my book to her High Expectations, because she always urged me to, you know, not to just rest on my laurels. But the important thing, she used to say, if you're a better student, then you need to help the others. Don't just say, well, I know mine. See what you can do with others.
Yes. Now, I am originally from the Caribbean, from Barbados in particular, and growing up in an environment where the vast majority of people around me were people of African descent, but certainly there were distinctions by gradation of color. For example, if you were lighter skinned, if you were darker skinned, the quality of your hair, you know, all of that made a difference. And of course, the lighter you were and the closer you were to European type features, you had a better chance in the world.
Sure.
Did you notice or experience that kind of
thing? Yes, there was a lot of that. And I think the thing that always got me was that within our own community, there was this kind of selection or preferential treatment based upon these things. And from a child, I always made it a point to, to embrace whoever it was. And one of the things I'm grateful for growing up in the kind of community and home I did was that I learned a lot about how people of different backgrounds can relate to one another. My brother married a Canadian, and when I saw how she was treated because she was a Canadian, I was concerned about her too. But I was also more concerned about what was happening to those who were black, because they were often not given the chance that I really felt they should have, that we should have.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that, because in the 1960s, you know, in the kind of height of, you know, black power and that whole kind of separation, you know, well, as black people, we just need to be on our own and not deal with anyone else. You were involved in this Wednesdays in Mississippi with interracial groups of women helping out at the Freedom Schools. Why did you think it was important for us to be able to work with people across race, but at the same time to stay focused on uplifting people of African descent and anyone who was suffering?
Well, I had also worked with the Harlem Youth Group, and we had a little United Youth Committee Against Lynching. We had one on against the chain gang that I had worked within the community on that. But in the height of the civil rights movement, the program in Mississippi that was geared to the freedom schools so that young people would be prepared when the Civil Rights Act went into effect was one that was really very challenging. And one of my very good friends and a board member, Polly Cowan, suggested that since they were the people in Mississippi were calling the students black and white who were coming down there to help and to teach, they were calling them, they said they were communists. And Mrs. Cowan said to me, she said, you know, my children are going and they're not communists and we understand this. So we said, she suggested that we ask what she called the Cadillac crowd to put ourselves online, to stand up, to back these kids, to support them, and to do it by going in on them to what we call Wednesdays at Mississippi, preparing and going in on Tuesday, but being there all day Wednesday in the schools, teaching, sharing whatever we could, then assessing where we were and coming back home on Thursday, ready to tell the story of what we experienced, but to be of help. Over 100 women joined us. We went in interracial teams, and it was in the darkest days.
Wow.
We were at the times when we were in one place and a Molotov cocktail was thrown in the window just behind us. So that we had that, we were in that kind of climate. But it was a good thing because it showed that where women had a clear understanding of the issues and were ready to join hands, that we could make a difference. And I think that's why today the pattern that we established is now being looked at, because we need ways in which people of different backgrounds work together and really not only look at the problems other people have, but look at themselves and how we can change our own communities.
Yes, and so you really were taking your lives in your hands.
Really was.
Yes, I heard the actor and activist Harry Belafonte speak earlier this week on the Martin Luther King holiday.
Yes.
on Monday evening. And, you know, he was quite remarkable with a number of things, you know, that he said. But on the question of terrorism, he said, you know, people are very focused on the threat of terrorism now. But the bombing of those children that happened in the church, that was terrorism. And it seems to me as though what you are describing of women going in and doing good work with Wednesdays in Mississippi and having Molotov cocktail, you
That's
know,
right.
thrown at you, that also is a form of terrorism. And growing up in the context of lynchings going on around.
And I remember even when those four little girls in the 16th Street Baptist Church.
That's right.
When they were bombed, Dr. King called me and asked if I would bring a group of women down, he said, because the mothers here were just distressed. And I'll never forget, we met at the home of Mrs. Gaston, whose motel had been bombed the morning that we were supposed to go, but the women still went.
Oh.
And as we were talking, one of the women said, she said she was so upset, she begged her little girl not to go out into the march. And she said, finally, she and her father sat down with her and tried to change her. And she said, why are you doing this? And she said, I changed my mind when my little girl said to me, if you were free, I'm marching so that you will be free. Because if you were free, you wouldn't have to take me to New York to try on clothes. They would let me try on clothes here in Birmingham. She said, I can never try on any dresses. You just buy dresses. She said, you always take me somewhere where I can have a nice time. She said, I like going to Europe, and I enjoy it, but I'd rather go to Tiny Touch Town right here where the white children go, because it's on the television all the time, the wonderful times they have. She said she understood then that the children knew what they were about, and that the marches were something that she could no longer urge her child to get out of, And she said, I have to support it. And I think we have to give credit to the fact, and Dr. King did all the time, that women and children and youth were the backbone of the march, of the marches and of the rallies, and that they were willing to take risks, and they were also willing to step out. And little children were working to give people the right to vote.
Yes, absolutely. I'm so glad you actually raised that. I mean, two things. One is obviously for a family of privilege who were able to take their daughter to New York or were able to go to Europe, but nevertheless were discriminated against and kept out in their own hometown. But on the point of the role of women and children in the civil rights movement, I wondered if we could elaborate on that a bit. The program that I did for Dr. King birthday interviewed a woman of the church, still active in her church, and talked about the role the women in the church played during that period. And we all know the role of that women more or less keep the church going, you know, with the volunteer work, etc. But in the civil rights movement, the fact that the church really provided the platform for Dr. King really meant that women were really central in that movement, as you have just mentioned.
And Dr. King gave great credit to it. In a speech at the Riverside Church in New York, he once said that he wanted to pay tribute to the women, because he said even women do, and he always made it, brought it right down. He said, you know, even the fact that the women will prepare refreshments help us to get the crowd out. He said, but they also are there supporting and bringing their children and standing up. And he said, and I also think one day the South will rise up and thank the 72-year-old woman who was one of the heroes and realize that she's typical of the heroes who, in the Montgomery boycott, when they were trying to get the buses desegregated, that this old woman refused to take a ride. She said, my feet may be tired, but my soul is rested. And he said, that's the spirit that women have brought into this whole movement.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. I actually love that quote. I'm so thrilled that you remembered it and brought it out. And also, I was really excited to read, of course, Mary McLeod Bethune, who was the founder and president of the National Council of Negro Women, noticed you, and you were the assistant director of the Harlem YWCA. And, you know, as a teenager living in Brooklyn, New York City, my sister and I spent a summer volunteering at the Harlem Y.
Oh,
we would take the train up and, you know, get off on that stop, take the number 2 train there. And there seems to be that connection. Somehow the Harlem Y, still even then, was a kind of a magnet for people, you know, who felt that it was important to do community work. And, of course, our family thought it was very important for us to do community work. Of course, that also led to us getting a job the following summer where we were actually hired, as you know, to help with the day camp that was going on there. But the I wanted to ask about the National Council of Negro Women, because so frequently, as women of African descent, when we get together as women, they say, well, why are you doing it as women? Why don't you have the National Council of Negroes for everybody? And of course, Negroes, for those who are listening in our audience and who are very shocked by the name National Council of Negro Women, you must remember when this organization was founded.
1935,
at a time that we were all referred to as Negroes, okay? So that, to, you know, put that one to rest. But why did you think it was important, and you stayed with it for so many years, to be working with women?
Well, I think Mary McLeod Bethune, who founded the National Council of Negro Women, was one I met on November the 7th, 1937, and I had the assignment to escort Eleanor Roosevelt into a meeting she was holding. Turned out to be the National Council of Negro Women. And she asked me my name and asked me to come back, and I've been back ever since. But through those two women, I came to understand that women carry a great portion of responsibility, but that we had to come to an understanding of ourselves as persons. and of our responsibility, not only to ourselves and to our families, but into the community. And I cherish the fact, and I tried to write about it in my memoirs, that I had that those two women, from that day until for the rest of their lives, were a great influence in my life. Mrs. Roosevelt, the next year, in 1938, I was one of 10 young people that she brought to Hyde Park to plan, spend a weekend with her to help plan for the World Youth Congress. And I was active in that. And I've been active with the National Council of Negro Women ever since. It was actually she, Mrs. Bethune, who said, "The freedom gates are half ajar, and we must pry them fully open." That's where I got the title for my book, Open Wide, The Freedom Gate, because she taught that, and she gave you the recognize that we have collective power, and we have to use it and use it wisely.
I love that, open wide the freedom gate,
yes.
You know, because it really gives you that sense of inclusiveness,
yes,
as well. You're listening to Sojourner Truth. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, talking with the very fascinating Dr. Dorothy Height, who has been active on behalf of the rights of people of African descent and indeed the rights of all people for most of her life. And of course, she was born on March 24th, 1912. Getting back to that particular period, I know there was the time that Marian Anderson, for example, was involved in that struggle to really get her. She was denied the ability to perform, and then she was invited to Washington, D.C. The great, for those of the young folks out there who don't know who Marian Anderson is, she's just a wonderful, wonderful opera singer that really made the way for so many that followed her. Were you involved in that in some way? Did you meet her?
I was there on Easter Sunday, 1939.
Oh, were you there at that place?
When Marian Anderson had been denied the opportunity to sing at Constitution Hall by the Daughters of American Revolution.
That's it.
And Mrs. Roosevelt resigned from her membership when that happened. But Mrs. Bethune and Mrs. Roosevelt worked together, and Secretary Ickes of the Department of the Interior made arrangements for Marian Anderson to sing at the Lincoln Memorial, the very place where Dr. King made his speech years later. But you know, what was so wonderful about it was that here was a woman denied the opportunity to sing. The community, at least in the African-American community, was very upset about it.
Yes.
And when Marian Anderson, on that Sunday morning, stepped forward, there must have been 75 to 100,000 people out there to hear her.
Wow.
And as she stepped forward, the first words out of her mouth were, "My country, 'tis of thee I sing, sweet land of liberty." The crowd just burst wide open. It was just an unbelievable experience. I thought, when I experienced that I would never have another experience like that. But I think the only one I know that matches it is Dr. King's speech in 1963.
Absolutely. That must have been, you know, quite a moment, and to really have played a part, you know, in that history. Now, you were also, getting back for a moment to the work that you've done with women, I know that you were involved in the United Nations, the work, you know, of the United Nations on behalf of women. And in your travels, you spent some time in India. You also have been to Latin America, to Asia, to Africa. Did you find that traveling internationally helped to inform and strengthen the work that you were doing in the United States on behalf not only of African-American women, but the community as a whole?
When you asked me why I wrote my memoirs, one of the reasons was that when I was 24 years old, I had the opportunity to be one of the American youth delegates to the World Conference of the Churches in Oxford, England. At a later time in life, in 1952, I taught in India. But I also, in 1957, made a study of the training needs of women in five West African countries. I would say that the you know, as people say, traveling is broadening. But I think it is more than that. I think it not only awakens in you more understanding of who you are yourself. I know that's what happened to me. But it also gives one a new view of how it is that we as a people have contributed wherever we have been, wherever we are.
That's right.
And to be able to join hands with women throughout the whole African diaspora has been a really rich experience for me. And it's something that I think that I'm happiest about seeing now, that we have come out of that dark view that Africa was some far-off continent, or that somehow the people of Asia were far away. But we've come to a better understanding, and I think the United Nations Decade for Women contributed to it, so that they created what I would call is a new day for women.
Yes, absolutely. And I recently did an interview with Nora Castaneda, who is the president of the Women's Development Bank Venezuela. And asking her, they have a new constitution of Venezuela that's considered one of the most advanced in the world. They have one Article 88 where women's rights are just unprecedented. In no constitution anywhere will you find the rights that they have achieved in Article 88, including counting caregiving work, the work that, you know, of mothers and other caregivers' work as productive and included in Social Security. But one of the things she said is that they looked at the document that came from the United Nations Decade for Women, the document in Beijing, and that many of the things that came out of that conference and came out of that document, they were then able to fight for and apply in Venezuela. So you never know how That's your right. work in the UN Women's Decade, what that has meant for women throughout the world.
And, you know, really, as proud as we are as American women, we have to acknowledge that even in some of the African countries today, they have more women in the parliament than we have in our Congress, a higher percentage of women, and that women are advancing. And I think the forward-looking policies that came out of Beijing and out of all of the decade conferences helped to clarify what the issues were and to help us move forward. We still have a long way to go.
Absolutely. One of the another recent interview that I did not that long ago with Caribbean writer George Lamming, who's the author of a wonderful book called In the Castle of My Skin. I hope you'll have a chance to take a look at that book. He's based in the Caribbean, and one of the things he said that was very unfortunate is that for people of African descent living outside of the United States, and indeed not only of African descent, for people living outside of the United States, period, that their view today of people of African descent living in the United States comes from film. And of course, we know what that must mean, that there's very, very little information, in fact, coming about what, you know, regular people are doing besides the kind of, unfortunately, caricatures that you see these days in film. And I wondered if you wanted to comment on that, if you wanted to comment on, having traveled abroad, the concern that you may have or may not have about the image people around the world have of people living in the United States today. When we were at the height of the civil rights movement, that was another matter. But we're looking today where our movement is rather low.
I think that in a real way, the image they have of women of African descent has been drawn from what you call caricatures, and I think that is it. The strength that, let me just say, the South African women showed, their ability to not only stand up, but to risk their lives. I was there in 1977, and they were threatened if they would come to a meeting that their buses would be blown up. And yet over 300 of them came to a meeting.
Yes.
And they took the stands that they wanted to stand. And it's the United Nations meetings have gone, the rise you will see of women of African descent from the Caribbean, from Africa and all, shows to us that there is not only talent, but women are not only, and women are prepared and are not only talking, but acting. And there has been considerable change even in the administrations of their countries. In a sense, we in the United States have to run fast to keep up with some of them.
The leadership coming from elsewhere. I'm so glad you mentioned that. One of the things that we've begun to do on International Women's Day to really just try to spread things out is that several of us are involved in something called the Global Women's Strike that we do on March the 8th. It's very grassroots. Many countries in Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean participate. And I was really moved by the stories of the women in the villages of Uganda who would walk for 3 days carrying their children with very little food to get to the center to be able to come together and discuss their demands. And then they were so thrilled when they wrote us and they said, as a result of the strike, my husband has given me a cow, or I now have the right to own a piece of land. Or the indigenous women, the Aymara and Quechua women in the Andes, who again walk for one and a half,
That's right.
2 days to get to a meeting. And here in the United States, we're like, oh, gee, it's across town. You know, I live in East L.A. It's in West L.A. I can't be bothered. So when you talk about the strength that you witnessed of the women in South Africa and the women on the continent, today we're seeing that kind of strength and that kind of leadership coming from those places.
Yes.
And we hope that it reaches us and inspires us.
Yes,
right,
and you know,
in
our
United
history,
States.
We have that leadership.
Yeah.
When we talk about Bethune and Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman and Mary Church, when we talk about the women of the past, and when we talk about the Rosa Parks and the Daisy Bates and the women of the present.
Yes.
And I think that's what I hope that something, even I hope that reading my memoirs will stimulate more young women to give more attention to what is happening, not only to themselves, but what is happening to people, because that's been the driving force there in all of these strong women. I remember the slogan of the South African women who said, when you touch the women, you struck a rock. You unleash the boulder, you will be crushed. And they said that to the face of those who were trying to impose Bantu education on their children. And I think that we have that same vigor, and I just hope that more and more of us will try to pick it up and do in today what those women of the past did.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of the Sojourner Truth edition of Morning Review, talking with the very fascinating Dr. Dorothy Height. And Dr. Height has a new book out called Open Wide the Freedom Gates. Before we finish, and it's amazing how the time has flown, I know you have another event to go on to, I would like to take a look at today. You talked about hoping with your book that people will find the kind of inspiration that has inspired you throughout your life and was further reinforced in your travels to Africa and to other parts of the world. Looking at the situation that we find ourselves today, where in the Black community, the African American community, those people who are poor are poorer today than they were a few decades ago, where you have a tremendous amount of money of the resources of the United States going into war, going into the military, where there is vigorous recruiting going on of youth of color to go into the military who see no other alternatives, where you see one out of four young Black men going to jail, where there are more in jail than are in universities. That's happening in this country on the one hand. And then on the other hand, across the border, you have success stories like in Venezuela, where they're trying to use the oil revenue to uplift the poor people, where we're in Brazil with the largest population of people of African descent in the entire mm-hmm. Western Hemisphere. You now have a president that is trying to move in the direction of upliftment of people. What would you say to us today that are trying to make sense out of all of this?
Well, I think, you know, I think that always strikes me, especially in the months of January and February, when we're talking about Dr. King or talking about our African-American history. I wish we could do more in helping our young people understand who they are and their past, and that we could just, for example, use the idea that the little children had. They were working hard and risking their lives so that their parents could vote. And I wish that we could stir ourselves up to realize that every person of voting age should take an active hand and should vote, and should do it with an understanding of the vision that we have of the kind of world we want to live in. And I believe that we're also at a point now where we can no longer afford the luxury of having those who have had the benefits of the doors being open not even understand how they got open. I think we must never forget what the struggle has been. I think that's been, I was on the Holocaust Memorial Council, and I came to appreciate what it meant that forever the Jewish community was saying, lest we forget. And I think that I would say it's lest we forget. But also that it isn't that all of us cannot do what Dr. King did. But Dr. King said, anyone can be great because everyone can volunteer. We can all step up and see what it is that we can do that would help to bring better understanding of not only who we are, but would encourage more of our young people to get away from those things that are tearing us apart and strengthen themselves and prepare for a greater future. You know, Harriet Tubman kept saying, you come to a point, and she said, you have to look back, move forward, but keep going. And I think that's what we've done. We've done a lot now. We have the civil rights laws, but we've got to keep going.
Well, inspiring words indeed. Thank you so much for all that you have done and for joining us today.
It's been great being with you.
Thank you so much.
Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank all who made this show possible, including today's engineer. I would love to hear from you. You can email me directly at mpkpfk@gmail.com. If you're a member of Facebook, remember to friend and like us, please. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott and check out our website at sotrueradio.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the return of Portland Folk Music Society concerts with artists who tour nationally. The five concert series